The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show, the Friday show, the last show of the week. I'm speaking to you from our Edstone campus on what is not a bright, sunshiny day. But we've had so much sun and warm weather of late that you actually appreciate the rain that we're getting right about now. In fact, I think some of our acreage could probably use a drink. So a nice day to be inside, looking out the window at the beautiful rain, and of course a nice day as always to get behind the mic and to finish up the week on a strong note. Coming up on today's program, you might want to gather your children, particularly those that might be a little bit older that are looking to get into some summer employment of some kind. We've had lots of activity around the Edstone campus here with some of the younger students, the Imperial students on hand that are getting a little extra work in, getting in some hours of work. And as I've said before on this program, that's something that that both of my children, they haven't had a lot of work experience. And so if you stay tuned to the next segment, the second segment on today's show, I'll give you a little bit of insight into a family discussion and study that we had recently. This was something that I told both of my children as they got ready to pitch in and do some work and get in some hours working for God's church, working for the grounds, working for the campus here, the regional office. And I gave them some tidbits to think on as they went about their daily responsibilities. So stay tuned for what will hopefully be a fairly lengthy Bible study coming up in the next segment. Well, just a few updates on the work, as I typically try to do or here at the start of, at least the start of Friday's program. My father's personal appearance campaign, that's coming up at the end of June, June 24th, so that's just a month away. That, of course, is in Toronto, Canada. I think we've had close to 200 calls thus far in the month of May, and so it's looking like it might bring in more people than the Los Angeles campaign in January. So those are some good reports, but that's on June the 24th and the 25th. And if you'd like to attend that or are interested in that, actually, I don't even know where to send you, but go to the trumpet.com or go to the PCOG site. You can figure out a way, hopefully, or email the TD program and I can forward it to the right people. That's TD@kpcg.fm. This weekend's Key of David program, it's going to be actually a condensed version, I believe, of my father's commencement address from May the 13th. We played the entirety of that address on this show, I think, a few weeks ago, 2 weeks ago, whenever that was. But in any event, if you didn't hear that, whether the live broadcast that Sunday night or that Sunday afternoon, depending upon where you live, or if you didn't hear it the next day when we played it on the radio, now is your chance. This weekend is a good opportunity. If you did hear that, you'll remember my father talked about his priority for that speech. It was to get the students of God's College to think more seriously about Herbert Armstrong's final work, Mystery of the Ages. And here he admonished the young people in God's College to really fall in love with that book. As he said, this book will tell you absolutely that you can remove the mystery, that mystery. And what an absolute marvelous blessing that is to understand the human mind. That's the subject of my father's commencement address and the subject for this weekend's Key of David program, Mysteries of the Human Mind. Well, this week we also posted the latest edition of our Trumpet magazine. Of course, that goes out to mailboxes all over the world every month. But we also posted online at our website, thetrumpet.com. And this month, for those of you tiring of me plugging the feature from the last issue, Saving America from the Radical Left Temporarily, you'll be happy to know that this month's feature is on the deep state. So it continues. But as Joel Hilliker brought out in the Trumpet brief on Wednesday, he said the scandals and the infighting plaguing America's government are one of the most prophetically significant developments in our world right now. And that's why we have hammered away at it in the Trumpet magazine and in those booklets that I keep plugging, Great Again and America Under Attack. But that issue in particular, the new July issue of the Trumpet magazine, it will really help you, I think, to understand why this is so important from a prophetic standpoint. My father has an article in there, a warning to America from our greatest past presidents. He had a program, a Key of David program on this recently, referring to the examples of George Washington and Abraham Lincoln. And that's a good lead-in then to Andrew Miller's feature in this upcoming or forthcoming Trumpet magazine. Is the deep state real? Is it real? He says, whether we call it the deep state, I think this is Joel Hilliker writing about actually, he's quoting Andrew here. It says, whether we call it the deep state or something else, it is undeniable that Washington has a deeply embedded bureaucracy that has existed for decades. Many of these bureaucrats staunchly oppose President Trump and his inner circle. The problems this reality creates represent an enormous distortion of how America's founders established the government. They're staunchly opposed to this current administration. I touched on that yesterday, and it was interesting to just read Carolyn Glick's column today in my news reports. It ties right in with what we discussed on yesterday's program. But just to give you a few snippets from her column, it says, never in U.S. history has a president been demonized and delegitimized by his political opponents as Mr. Trump has been by Democrats. Since the day he was elected, Democrats have sought to overturn the election results. It's been that way since the day he was elected in November of 2016. It's a never-ending story. And of course, more and more details continue to come out. And we're doing our best to keep up with it, to present the truth. I'll talk more about truth here in just a second. But Carolyn Glick says here, let me just get to the conclusion. She says, given this background, dozens of Democratic lawmakers, she's basically talking about the move of the embassy and how that, as I pointed out on this show a few weeks ago, this is something that from 1995 to this day, I mean, for well over 20 years, everyone was on board with it, Republicans and Democrats alike. But as she brings out, as soon as President Trump actually makes the move, something that all of the congressmen and women wanted to do, judging by their voting history, as soon as President Trump makes the move, well, then they flip-flop. Then they're immediately opposed to it. Now the world's coming to an end because President Trump did it. It says, given this background, dozens of Democratic lawmakers could have been expected to come to Jerusalem for the embassy opening last week, and still more could have been expected to put in an appearance at the Israeli embassy's bash in Washington. Instead, with some notable if constrained exceptions, Trump's move was met with stony silence by the vast majority of Democrats and several powerful lawmakers, including House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi and prominent senators Dianne Feinstein, Dick Durbin, Chris Murphy, and Bernie Sanders condemned the move. They condemned it. I think Richard Palmer was telling me this morning that Dianne Feinstein was supportive of it as recently as a year ago. Now she's condemning it. It says the only possible explanation for their abrupt abandonment of a policy they had dutifully followed for 23 years is Donald Trump. They revile him and reject him to such a degree that they prefer to abandon long-held positions than admit that he did exactly what they have wanted the president to do for the past 23 years. Here they are, just blinded by their political bias, by their hatred for their political opponent. Is the deep state real? Everything you need to know on this subject is coming out in the latest Trumpet magazine. If you aren't a subscriber to the Trumpet, the print edition of the Trumpet magazine, you can get a subscription at our website, thetrumpet.com. In addition to Andrew's feature there, there's a really helpful infographic on America's deep state included in the center spread of that Trumpet magazine. So that's something that we probably don't give enough attention to on the website. But if you subscribe to the magazine, you're familiar with those regular infographics. So make sure that you track down that July issue of the Trumpet magazine. I have an article in there, by the way, on what was the title of it? The war, or the U.S. government. It's at war with itself. So you can look for that and a lot more in the latest Trumpet magazine. Well, speaking of Joel Hilliker reporting on that Trumpet magazine on what was it, Wednesday? Yesterday, he had another Trumpet brief. He's on fire this week. A lengthy Trumpet brief on inspiring lessons from the Battle of Britain. I guess this springs from his Trumpet Hour. I didn't get a chance to listen to that yet, the Wednesday program. But the lessons from the Battle of Britain, and he ties in the fact that, you know, we've got to be like those fighter pilots back in 1940 in those Spitfires. As Mr. Hilliker brings out, we're living in historic times. There's so much at stake. And, I mean, whether, as he said, whether we realize it or not, Bible prophecy shows that this world is on the brink of World War III. And it's going to be worse than any war in history. I mean, following World War I, nobody wanted to see another world war. People thought on and meditated on anything except the reality of an oncoming world war. As I touched on yesterday, they looked for any way to escape reality, to say that, well, surely Hitler's not going to do this. Surely he's not going to do that. And then when they were confronted with it, well, it was almost too late. Mr. Hilliker in his brief chimes in that, spiritually speaking, I mean, we've got to be that courageous, that willing to proclaim God's truth to this world. We can't escape the reality of what is prophesied. Jesus said, "You shall know the truth, and the truth is what makes you free." I referred to 2 Peter 3 yesterday, that section of Scripture where it talks about the return of Jesus Christ and how that so many people would scoff at these prophecies. And Peter said, "For this they willingly are ignorant of." They're willingly ignorant. They just won't have it. They won't hear it. They won't accept it. As God's people, we have to think prophetically. How does this, it's like he brought out in the Trumpet brief Wednesday. I mean, how does this factor into prophecy? Here you look at the deep state, the scandals plaguing America's government right now. All of that, I mean, it's one of the most prophetically significant developments in our world today. And the world needs to hear this truth. And to learn from even relatively recent history from the 1930s. People wanted to run away. And as William Manchester says in his book on Churchill, for those that were looking for a way of escape, well, there was a smorgasbord of entertainments that they could pursue. You know, he makes an interesting point about Britain and all of its entertainment in the 1930s and the trends and the fashions and everything that people were doing to just get their minds off of reality. This was in 1938, I believe, in Manchester. He makes a hard-hitting point at one point in his biography when he says, you know, and one people or one nation that wasn't celebrating, that wasn't getting all caught up into escapism, was Czechoslovakia. Austria, of course, had just been devoured. And now the Czechs, they were waiting there, hunkering down, fearing what would come next. And many in the West, many in the media, many powerful Western leaders, they were quite happy to sacrifice Czechoslovakia in order to appease Hitler. Following the Anschluss, following the takeover of Austria, Churchill was there really pushing for what he called the Grand Alliance. I guess others might have called it that too. But basically, you know, we've got to get together with France and with these Eastern European countries and fight against Hitler. We've got to confront him. We've got to face him down. And Chamberlain, I think he confided in some of his advisors saying, well, I gave some thought to that. But basically, Chamberlain concluded that he didn't really trust the French. He didn't really trust some of those Eastern European nations. So he didn't want to build this alliance to face Hitler. I mean, in so many ways, he trusted Germany more than he trusted France. It's unbelievable, this history. How much have we learned from it? Churchill said, before we cast away this hope, that is the hope of uniting together to fight the Nazi menace, he said, this cause and this plan, which I do not at all disguise as an element of risk. I mean, there was some risk to it, of course. You had to fight this Nazi machine. He says, let those who wish to reject it ponder well and earnestly upon what will happen to us if, when all else has been thrown to the wolves, we are left to face our fate alone. That's what he said in 1938. And of course, it was spot on. That's exactly what happened. That's what Joel Hilliker wrote about in his trumpet brief yesterday. The Battle of Britain, I mean, Britain was alone. Everyone else had been defeated already by that point. France fell in 6 weeks, the most powerful army in the world at the time. And it was conquered. 6 weeks. And Britain stood alone. And what Joel Hilliker was writing about in his trumpet brief yesterday, I mean, that's a powerful story, what happened in 1940 and Churchill rousing the nation of Britain from sleep to fight, to confront. But the thing is, he had been practically screaming for that for 7, 8, 9 years. Rearm and confront. We have to rearm and confront. And people called him the scaremonger. They called him the warmonger. Lord Boothby, he looked back upon those days of appeasement from 1935 to 1939. These are the years before the Battle of Britain. These are the years immediately before that inspiring story of courage, of standing up to Hitler. In writing about those appeasement years before they finally were alone and had to fight alone, he says, from 1935, this is a commentator after the war looking back on it, he says, from 1935 to 1939, I watched the political leaders of Britain, and with only two exceptions, Winston Churchill and Leopold Amory. I'm not familiar with the latter one there. Churchill, obviously. It says they were frightened men, with the exception of Churchill and Amory. They were frightened men, the leaders in Britain. They were frightened. They didn't want to offend Hitler. Boothby says, on four occasions, Hitler and his gang of bloody murderers could have been brought down and the Second World War averted by an ultimatum. Every time we failed to do it. And four times is a lot, Boothby says. Four times in 5 years. We could have brought down that Nazi machine. We could have stopped it in its tracks. And a world war could have been averted. And every time we failed to do it, and as he says, four times, that's a lot. The reason for it, I'm afraid, can only be ascribed to a squalid combination of cowardice and greed. And the British ministers responsible, instead of being promoted, should have been impeached. See, all through the 30s, I mean, they were being promoted for these views. for these policies, for their agendas, their agenda of appeasement, they were rising to the top. I mean, Churchill couldn't even find a spot on a cabinet with Baldwin or with Chamberlain. All of that experience, all of those years and those top positions that he had had in the UK government. And yet he was alone. He just had a handful of members of parliament that supported him, four or five people. But there he was, a voice crying in the wilderness. Nobody listened. Boothby says, we had four opportunities in a five-year span to put a stop to these bloody murders. And every time we failed to do it. Can you see why Churchill later called that war the unnecessary war? It was totally unnecessary. It could have been prevented had the democracies of Europe simply rearmed and confronted in 1936, in 1937, in 1938. Then finally in 1939 and 1940, Britain stood up to confront, and it had to do it alone. Back in 1935, there was a lot of debate about the strength of the British Air Force. Mr. Hilliker talked about the British Air Force in 1940. Well, during the 1930s, the Germans, they were building planes. What did he say in his trumpet brief? I think something like 160 per month, the Germans. And you had all of the appeasers saying, that's okay, that's all right. They can back out of the Treaty of Versailles. They can go ahead and rearm because, you know, we'll rearm too. And we've got enough planes to do this, that, and the other. And basically, they were just lying. And Churchill's sources were more credible. He was getting the truth. He was saying, Germany's passing us. Well, that was finally confirmed in 1935. Even after all of these assurances from Baldwin and others, don't worry, everything's okay. We're stronger than Germany. Well, after it came out, after it was obvious that the UK government was dead wrong about German rearmament, Churchill said this in the House of Commons. He said, when the situation was manageable, it was neglected. And now that it is thoroughly out of hand, we apply too late the remedies which then might have effected a cure. There's nothing new in the story. It's as old as the Sibylline books. It falls into that long, dismal catalog of the fruitlessness of experience and the confirmed unteachability of mankind, want of foresight, unwillingness to act, when action would be simple and effective, lack of clear thinking, confusion of counsel. Until the emergency comes, until self-preservation strikes its jarring gong, these are the features which constitute the endless repetition of history. Famous speech. That was way back in the middle of 1935. That was before Hitler devoured Czechoslovakia and Austria. That was before German forces entered into the Rhineland. They found out Germany's Air Force, it's a force to be reckoned with. And Churchill had been warning about it, but no one listened. He said in that same speech, is there a member of the government who will get up now and say that in November next year, we shall still have a 50% superiority over Germany? That's what the government had said, I think in the November previous to this speech. Totally, totally wrong. A complete lie. He says, is there a member of the government who will still assert that in March last year, 6 weeks ago, or rather March last, 6 weeks ago, we had a substantial superiority? That's what they were saying. representatives of Baldwin's government, they were saying, even as recently as 6 weeks previous to this House of Commons speech, that we have a substantial superiority. Churchill says, no, sir, no one's going to say that now. The whole of these assertions, made in the most sweeping manner and on the highest authority, are now admitted to be entirely wrong. And you know what was even more astounding in Churchill's mind? The fact that even after they were proven to be flat out wrong, there was still, this is 1935, keep in mind, the people of Britain were still indifferent. They didn't care about German air strength. They didn't care about a dishonest government of their own. They just carried on with their escapism. Surely we're never going to have another world war. I mean, we lost 10 million boys in the trenches in the Great War. That's not going to happen again. That couldn't happen again. Well, Churchill said all of these stats, these figures, this truth, it confirms the unteachability of mankind. I mean, it's a lesson as old as an old nursery rhyme. And it just keeps repeating itself. You know, it's amazing. We're right in the middle of the second volume of Manchester's work on Churchill. And as I was saying to a few people yesterday, I mean, if you take the heart of that second volume, it's most of the nuggets that you find in reading the long biography, they're in our short little booklet, Winston S. Churchill, The Watchman. Andrew Locher plugged that a few weeks ago when he subbed in for me. It's a fantastic little booklet. If you don't have time to get through the full-length three-volume set, that booklet really does a fantastic job of summing up this history and bringing out lessons like the one from this 1935 speech, the confirmed unteachability of mankind. Churchill was a voice in the wilderness. He was crying out, but people wanted to hear smooth things, as Isaiah 30 says. Churchill even paraphrased from that Bible passage. They wanted smooth things. They wanted people to tell them that everything's going to be okay. Don't worry about German air power. We have more power than them. We're stronger than them. That's what they wanted to hear. They didn't want to hear the truth. In fact, for those that did tell the truth, they were ridiculed, like Churchill. There were others. There were UK ambassadors that went to Germany that then reported back to Whitehall and said, hey, this is really bad. What's happening here? And guess what happened to those ambassadors? I think in at least two cases, they were sacked. They were fired. Don't go to Germany and then send back facts. Don't go to Germany and then send back the truth of what's really happening. Tell us smooth things so that we can then tell our people smooth things. Isn't that amazing? That's just in the 1930s. Only one prominent voice was crying out, and that was Winston Churchill. And Britain, finally, they finally turned to Winston Churchill in 1940. When it was almost too late. Read that trumpet brief by Joel Hilliker that came out last night for the rest of the story. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. When we come back, we'll get into our Bible study that your teenaged workers need to hear. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM. And this is the Trumpet Daily.
Perhaps no hour in Britain's history was darker than that preceding World War II. Nazi Germany was arming. Nations in Europe were being conquered, their borders redrawn. Britain, the nation that once ruled one quarter of the earth, teetered on the edge of survival. Many leaders in Britain feared war. They wanted to disarm. They spoke of peace as Europe sank deeper into the pit of war. This dark hour may have been Britain's last, were it not for one man. This man stood alone in the face of adversity at home and abroad. He rose to the occasion when his nation needed him most. He vowed that Britain would never surrender when confronted by forces of evil. Winston Churchill took Britain's most important job during Britain's darkest hour. He did what others were afraid to do. Some doubted his methods, but the results speak for themselves. Churchill led Britain from the precipice of ignominious defeat and possible death to what became one of the nation's brightest hours. What was it that made Winston Churchill so different from other leaders of his time? Surely now, more than ever, this world needs another Winston Churchill. Our booklet, Winston S. Churchill, The Watchman, explains what made this man such a great leader. We would like to offer this booklet to you free of charge. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily.
Well, we're heading into the summer months, and as I said at the top of the show, this is the time when a lot of teenagers, a lot of young people are out of school and looking for summer jobs. And as I was telling the students recently, I mean, even apart from the summer, at least if you go to God's college, your work, your daily work on the job, that makes up an important part, a significant chunk of your college training. Again, at God's college, it's not, I know it's not that way in the universities of today, where people take out loans and they're basically just going to class and then piling up all of this student debt that they've got to live with after college. It's very different at God's college. You come to God's college, you take the 15 to 18 hours of class time, and then you work as well, 20 to 22 hours on the job. And when you look at what happens after college, I mean, what we're going to be doing for all eternity, we're going to be working with God and with Jesus Christ. Jesus said, "My Father works and I work." God created us to work and to prepare for that work, whether it's a summer job, whether it's the work-study program at Armstrong College, whether it's work after college, whether it's work at school or in the family. It's absolutely essential that all of us learn how to follow instructions, and to follow instructions to a T. This is the main thing I tried to tell my children as they headed into some summer work of their own. Just really be diligent and make sure that you follow instructions. There's lots of other things to remember. Obviously, I've talked a lot about not wasting time and making sure, you know, when you clock in, you're on the job. I mean, you're being paid for that time. And so make sure you're putting in a good day's work or a good shift on the job. But follow instructions. Listen to the instructions that your supervisor gives. And really follow through on them. Carry them out to a T. This is from a Good News article from 1986. It says, just as a musician needs constant training and practice to become good enough to play in an orchestra, so a child needs constant training based on the laws God reveals to develop self-discipline. A child must be taught to carry out responsibilities, whether schoolwork, chores, around the home, controlling emotions, or exercising the patience and the diligence needed to learn a new skill. And the same is true with respect to following instructions. That's something that we have to learn. That's something that parents should teach. It doesn't just come naturally. This article says, for instance, a teenager who has never learned about punctuality, getting along with others, and following instructions cannot just join the workforce and expect to be able to work successfully for a full 8 hours every day. He would find great difficulty in sticking out the often mundane assignments that regularly go with the job. He may not respect his superiors. He may not be concerned with doing quality work. Let's look at an example over in 1 Samuel chapter 13 on this point about following instructions. If we're concerned, if we really are concerned about doing quality work, even if it's in following through on the mundane tasks, then we've really got to learn how to follow instructions. And we all have jobs that have a certain amount of mundane tasks, but I think when it's a lower level, entry level type position, sometimes it may be somewhat mundane, and some teenagers, it's a real challenge for them to work hard, to work with efficiency, to be resourceful, to be productive. It's something, though, that you can learn. 1 Samuel 13 and verse 8, it says, "And he tarried 7 days according to the set time that Samuel had appointed. But Samuel came not to Gilgal, and the people were scattered from him." Now, I'm picking it up in the middle of the story here, but in 1 Samuel 10, it says that Samuel, the prophet, had told Saul, "Tarry here for 7 days, and then I'll come and show you what to do." So those are clear instructions. Saul was forbidden to take on any of the duties of the priesthood. Samuel said, "Don't do that. You wait here 7 days, and then I'll come at the end of 7 days and tell you what to do." Well, here in 1 Samuel 13, the Philistine army was advancing, and Saul was waiting on Samuel, but he was getting nervous. He thought, well, he's not going to show up on time. And then as the seventh day wore on, he started to worry all the more. And then he took matters into his own hands. Then he made a snap judgment. Verse 9, "And Saul said, 'Bring here the burnt offering to me and peace offerings.' And he offered the burnt offering. So Samuel didn't arrive soon enough, and Saul decided to officiate the sacrifices himself. And then he justified those actions by saying, well, it's an emergency. I had to do it. I had no choice. Verse 10 says, "And it came to pass that as soon as he had made an end of offering the burnt offering, behold, Samuel came, and Saul went out to meet him, that he might salute him. And Samuel said, 'What have you done?' And Saul said, 'Because I saw that the people were scattered from me, and that you came not within the days appointed, and that the Philistines gathered themselves together at Mishmash, therefore said I, the Philistines will come down now upon me to Gilgal, and I have not made supplication unto the Eternal. I forced myself, therefore, to offer a burnt offering.'" In other words, I had no choice. I mean, really, it's your fault. You didn't come soon enough. "And Samuel said to Saul, 'You have done foolishly. You have not kept the commandment of the Eternal your God, which he commanded you, for now would the Eternal have established your kingdom upon Israel forever.'" That's an incredible statement. God would have established his kingdom forever, Saul's kingdom, if he just would have obeyed God and followed those instructions. He would have been blessed. And the same is true for us. And all the more so in today's world, because it's rare to find employees on any job who are serious about following instructions to a T. Samuel continued, verse 14, "But now your kingdom shall not continue. The Eternal has sought him a man after his own heart, and the Eternal has commanded him to be captain over his people, because you have not kept that which the Eternal commanded you." It's a pretty harsh punishment. But look, God put Saul right at the top of his chosen nation, and he gave him his Holy Spirit. And he had a great prophet of God to look to for spiritual guidance and direction. He had a supervisor that could tell him everything that he needed to know and to do. And if he just would have done it, he could have been a smashing success. That's what this passage brings out. God would have established your kingdom forever if you would have just followed instructions, like an obedient child, like a submissive employee. Well, in the next chapter, this is 1 Samuel 14 and verse 24, it says, "And the men of Israel were distressed that day, for Saul had adjured the people, saying, 'Cursed be the man that eats any food until evening, that I may be avenged on my enemies.' So none of the people tasted any food." So here again, it's another incident where Saul makes a hasty judgment. He pronounces a curse, the curse of death, on anyone who failed to follow his instructions. Notice that. He gave instructions for the people under him to follow. And if you know anything about this story, Jonathan, his son, he didn't hear. He didn't hear the instructions. And he had eaten some honey that day. Down in verse 43, it says, "Then Saul said to Jonathan, 'Tell me what you've done.' And Jonathan told him and said, I did but taste a little honey with the end of the rod that was in my hand. And lo, I must die.' And Saul answered, 'God do so, and more also, for you shall surely die, Jonathan.'" So here is this king. He's prepared to kill his own son, even though his son had no idea that they weren't supposed to eat anything. It's really revealing, isn't it? When it came to his own instructions, I mean, Saul, he was very careful and particular. Well, if it's a subordinate of mine and I give the instructions, you better follow it. No questions, no exceptions. No exemptions here. You better follow my instructions. You better cross every T and dot every I. And yet, when it came to carrying out the instructions of his supervisor, well, Saul was very careless, wasn't he? He was very careless. He thought if he followed most of the instructions, that would be good enough. And that's the way human nature is. We can be very self-righteous when it comes to some decision that we make, something that we decide. Or we can be very biased, like you see in the political sphere in the United States. Well, if Mr. Obama says it, that's the absolute final, that's the final say right there. That's the rule. And then someone else comes along, Mr. Trump, I'm not going to obey him. I'm not going to carry out his order. That's what Sally Yates did. Human nature can be very self-righteous. We can be very particular when we're in the supervising position and say, you carry it out. If you don't carry it out, that's it. You're gone. It's over. Or in this case, your life is over. He said that to Jonathan. And then when it comes to carrying out the instructions of the supervisor over us, we reason around it. We justify our actions or lack thereof. In chapter 15, notice a few more high spots here. It says in verse 1, "Samuel also said unto Saul, 'The Eternal sent me to anoint you to be king over his people, over Israel. Now therefore hearken you unto the voice of the words of the Eternal. Thus says the Lord of hosts, I remember that which Amalek did to Israel, how that he laid wait for him in the way when he came up from Egypt. Now go and smite Amalek and utterly destroy all that they have and spare them not, but slay both man and woman, infant and suckling, ox and sheep, camel and ass.'" Here are more clear instructions. Nothing was to be spared. Nothing. So Saul gathers all the fighting men together, something like 200,000. And more then from Judah as well. And they went out and they destroyed the Amalekites. But they didn't do it the way God said to do it. Verse 7, "And Saul smote the Amalekites from Havilah until thou comest to Shur, that is over against Egypt. And he took Agag the king of the Amalekites alive and utterly destroyed all the people with the edge of the sword. But Saul and the people, spared Agag, and the best of the sheep, and of the oxen, and of the fatlings, and the lambs, and all that was good, and would not utterly destroy them, but everything that was vile and refuse, that they destroyed utterly." So here again, we see Saul not following through on all of the instructions he had been given. He followed most of them. He carried out the instructions that were easiest to carry out. I mean, destroying what's abominable and vile, that's not really that hard, is it? That was the easiest part. I mean, if Saul hated those vile practices of the Amalekites, it would have been a lot easier to wipe out that entirely. But in ridding the region of this paganism, this Amalekite paganism, he still failed to do what God said to do. He still did not follow the instructions of God's prophet. Maybe he completed 80% of the task, or 85%, or maybe even 95%. Verse 10 says, "Then came the word of the Eternal unto Samuel, saying, It repents me that I have set up Saul to be king, for he turned back from following me and has not performed my commandments. And it grieved Samuel, and he cried unto the Eternal all night." I mean, God was sorry for even selecting Saul in the first place. And Samuel, as you see there, I mean, he's just absolutely devastated by this. Grieved all night long. Samuel, the prophet, did, but not Saul. Saul had a pretty good night of sleep. Verse 12 says, "And when Samuel rose early to meet Saul in the morning, it was told Samuel, saying, Saul came to Carmel, and behold, he set up a place and has gone out and has gone about and passed on and now gone down to Gilgal. And Samuel came to Saul, and Saul said unto him, Blessed be you of the Eternal. I have performed the commandment of the Eternal." You know, I did everything just like you said. I give myself an A+. He was convinced. He was convinced that he had faithfully performed all of those instructions. And he was deceiving himself. It's easy to deceive yourself into thinking that you're doing it exactly the way the boss says to do it, exactly the way the boss wants it done. Verse 14, "And Samuel said, What mean then this bleating of the sheep in my ear? I mean, what about these sheep I hear? And the lowing of the oxen which I hear?" And Saul said, "They have brought them from the Amalekites, for the people..." Not me. I mean, "the people spared the best of the sheep and the oxen to sacrifice unto the Eternal your God. And the rest we have utterly destroyed." So he blames the people. And then he says, and in actual fact, I mean, "we just preserved these livestock so that we could sacrifice to God. Look at my heart. You've got to look at my heart here, Samuel. I'm right before God. I mean, we're obeying God. We're sacrificing before God. And the people, I mean, you've got to take into consideration these hard-headed people." Verse 16, "Then Samuel said unto Saul, Stay, and I will tell you what the Eternal has said to me this night. And he said unto him, Say on. And Samuel said, When you were little in your own sight, wast you not made the head of the tribes of Israel? And the Eternal anointed you king over Israel. When you were little," in other words, when you were younger, you were more humble. You weren't so vain and careless. You were more careful to follow instructions, but now look at you. Verse 18, "And the Eternal sent you on a journey and said, Go and utterly destroy the sinners and the Amalekites and fight against them until they be consumed. Wherefore then did you not obey the voice of the Eternal, but did fly upon the spoil and did eat in the sight of the Eternal?" I mean, I gave you such clear instructions. Why didn't you follow them? Verse 20, it says here, "And Saul said to Samuel, Yes, I have obeyed the voice of the Eternal, and have gone the way which the Eternal sent me, and have brought Agag, the king of Amalek, and have utterly destroyed the Amalekites. But the people took the spoil," he says again. The people did it. Still, he maintains, I follow, even after the correction from Samuel, he says, I followed your instructions. The people were careless, not me. He had a chance here to turn to God in repentance, and he didn't do it. Here's a case where someone followed God's instructions only up to a certain point. And because of that attitude, because of that unwillingness to follow through on all of God's instructions, God couldn't work with him anymore. The supervisor, you could say, he couldn't trust him. He couldn't rely upon him. And it's important to note here, I mean, Saul was still zealous. He still was making sacrifices. He still was religious, quote unquote. But when it came to carefully following the precise instructions of his God and of God's prophet, he didn't follow through all the way for God. And that's not going to cut it with our spiritual supervisor. Verse 22, Samuel said, has the Eternal as great delight in burning offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Eternal? It says, behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to hearken than the fat of lambs. To obey is better than sacrifice. See, obedience to God and following his instructions. Obedience and following instructions. That's what a good workman does, just to apply these lessons, these principles, to our work, whether physical or spiritual. To obey is better than sacrifice, and to hearken than the fat of rams, it says. For rebellion is as the sin of witchcraft, and stubbornness is as iniquity and idolatry. Says, because you have rejected the word of the Eternal, he has also rejected you from being king. It could have been different, as we've seen. He could have been a smashing success as a king, Saul. But he didn't follow God's instructions. And in the end, God rejected him. Verse 24 says, and Saul said unto Samuel, I have sinned, for I have transgressed the commandment of the Eternal, and your words, because I feared the people and obeyed their voice. Now therefore, I pray you, pardon my sin and turn again with me, that I may worship the Eternal. Well, it sounds good, those words, but he didn't repent from the heart. He wasn't willing to make the necessary changes to grow in godly character and to become perfect, to develop a perfect heart like King David would do later. And Samuel said to Saul, I will not return with you, for you have rejected the word of the Eternal, and the Eternal has rejected you from being king over Israel. And as Samuel turned about to go away, he laid hold upon the skirt of his mantle, and it rent. And Samuel said unto him, the Lord has rent the kingdom of Israel from you this day, and has given it to a neighbor of yours that is better than you. Of course, that neighbor was the little shepherd boy by the name of David. David was not like Saul. He had a heart like God's. He meditated continually on God's instruction. He followed through on God's instructions to a T. If you're a young person, or if you're anyone for that matter, heading off for summer work, remember these two examples while on the job. Remember these examples and follow the good one so that God can put more responsibilities on your shoulders. Mr. Hilliker, he wrote in a Royal Vision article about 12 years ago, he said, to prepare for your working life in the future, he's talking about, to prepare for your working life. I think he's talking more spiritual here. I mean, what we're going to be doing for all eternity. To prepare for your working life, strive to become skilled at following instructions precisely in your job today. It says, work to align your thinking with the man directly over you and try to extend his shadow. Strive to make him more effective in his job. Do your best to work in a way that prepares you for working within the framework of God's government. That's why God tells us to submit to our boss as unto Jesus Christ, even if he's a sinful, unqualified man. You can see that over in Ephesians 6 and 1 Peter 2. Submit to that supervision and really concentrate on following those instructions. Make sure that you pay attention when you hear the instructions. Write them down if you have to, so that you don't forget, so that you don't get careless. And just like it says in Ephesians 6, think about those instructions as if they're coming directly from Jesus Christ himself. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show as we put the finishing touches on another week of broadcasting here on KPCG. If you'd like to email us, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you next week.